it's important, just as Child Protective Services does not always find abuse, neither do we at Center for Miracles. And so the way that we like the system to be is to have a low threshold for reporting at the front line. So those are the pediatricians, the hospital folks, the emergency department folks. We want low threshold. And then if we look at the injury.
I'm Holly Waymont, and this is Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy pediatric practitioner. Click on the link in this podcast for free credit that may include CME, MOC, or ethics credit, depending on the topic or podcast. Today, we're talking about sexual abuse. Joining me here in the podcast studio is Dr. Nancy Kellogg. Dr. Kellogg is the division chief for child abuse pediatrics at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and she also works at the Center for Miracles. Dr. Kellogg, you completed medical school and pediatric residency at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and you evaluate children and adolescents for suspected abuse or neglect at the Center for Miracles. You're a professor of pediatrics, and you've served as a medical director of the Forensic Nurse Examiner Program at Children's Hospital of San Antonio for 16 years and program director, establishing one of the first child abuse pediatric fellowships following accreditation of a new specialty. You were appointed for 6 years to the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Child Abuse since 2006, and you've served as the medical editor for the American Board of Pediatric Child Abuse Pediatric Subboard for 17 years. You've been helping children who suffer from abuse since 1988. Yeah. What a difference you're making, and it must be such a hard job. I'm so honored to have you here in the podcast studio.
Oh, thank you. When we're talking about physical abuse, I would say to the biggest focus, the biggest concern would be in very young infants. So we have a term called sentinel injuries. And so sentinel injuries are unexplained injury, bruises that are visible on a premobile infant. And so with sentinel injuries, if we have a child that has an unexplained bruise on the chest or an unexplained subconjunctival hemorrhage or has a lacerated frenulum, which is the tissue inside the mouth, and we don't know why, we don't have a good explanation for it, those are things that need to be reported. Our infants are at greatest risk for the severe life-threatening type of abuse. And so those are the things that we need to report. We also need to do the complete medical workup. So there's a lot involved with that. It'll be blood work. We're looking for bleeding disorders, but we're also looking for what we call more subtle or occult injuries, like small fractures that might be in that baby. So we would be doing x-rays and we're doing CT scan. Those are the ones that are have the highest concern. As they get older, it really changes because the children get mobile. They're going to fall. They're going to get bruises. And we have to begin to look at where the bruises are. Is there a pattern to it that suggests an object was being used? What does the child say about the injury? So I cannot overstate the importance of a child's history. When you have a child who's verbal and who can tell you how they got that bruise or how they got that injury, I think it needs to be taken seriously. The same, especially the sexual abuse. To ask a child, what happened, or if they're beginning to disclose sexual abuse, to listen carefully. It's very hard for kids to talk about their abuse. And when you're attentive and you're receptive and you acknowledge your fear and you acknowledge their anxiety in telling you, it goes a long way in trying to help that child speak up and for the next steps to happen to make sure that child's safe. I always thank children that talk to me every single time. I think we have to remember, especially when we talk about sexual abuse, it takes about 2 years for a kid to tell about sexual abuse, for a child to tell someone about sexual abuse. Mm. And over those 2 years, a lot of things are happening. They are constantly debating whether to tell. And if they're school age, they're old enough to understand that if I tell, it might break up my family, somebody might go to jail, my mom is going to be unhappy, all of these things. My little brother will lose his parent. So all of these things are going through this child's head, and they're constantly thinking about, should I tell, should I not tell? I need to keep it secret. So when a child first tells, it's very important that they know that the person that they're talking to believes them. You don't have to take off your friend or your parent hat when somebody is telling you about abuse. You need to be listening to what they're saying, and you need to accept it, and you need to convey that you believe them. Because right at that point, that's critical. When kids first tell, they have these super sensitive antennas out. Mm-hmm. And they know, they're reading your nonverbal. They're reading your verbal. They're trying to see, does this person believe me? And so if you like, well, are you sure that happened? Or maybe it was just a dream. Kids were they're gonna take back what they said at that when they hear that. If there's any doubt, they would take it back. And so I would say that if you're one of the first people, if you're the first person that a child is telling, it's very important that you listen, you have empathic listening, and that you say, I believe you, I want to help you. This is what we need to do next.
Dr. Kelly, what do you recommend we do next?
When you have a child that has made a clear statement, and I think you just have to verify that, because if you say, so-and-so hurt me, that can mean a lot of things. That could be sibling play. That could be anything. And so just knowing, if you get to the point where you have a child who's verbal, who understands speech, who's normal development for their age, can understand your questions, and can respond appropriately to questions, and they indicate that they were sexually abused, this person touched them in a place that should not have been touched, then I think the response is first, thank you for telling me. I really appreciate that you trusted me with this. We need to do some things to keep you safe right here and now. This is what I'm going to do. And so you always want to be transparent with kids. You don't want to make promises you can't keep. You can't say, this will never happen to you again. You don't know that. But you can say, I'm going to tell you everything I'm going to do, and I will explain it to you. So, of course, what happens next depends a little bit on the situation. So if a child is telling you and you're not in the family, if you're a professional, they say, first thing we need to do is to talk to your mom about this, and we're going to need to talk to some other people that can come and help figure out everything that's going on. And they can also make a plan to be sure that you're safe. And again, that may be too strong a promise, but to say they're going to come and look at ways to keep you safe, I think would be an appropriate thing to do. You have to be so careful about what you say to kids. You don't, again, want to make some promise. Your heart jumps out to them. You want to tell them it's not going to happen. You want to make it better. But all you really can do is to be honest and transparent with the child and respectful and grateful that they told you.
So say if we're in the exam room setting for the pediatrician, you thank the child, then you can discreetly call CPS. The parent doesn't need to know you're doing that, because what if it is the parent or caregiver who brought the child in, who's right there in the exam room?
Right. Well, and that's why it's important when a child makes a statement to you, you need to understand who the adult is that's with the child right now. And with sexual abuse, many times it's the mom bringing the child in, and many times it's not the mom who's the sex offender. So if it's not the abuser that's bringing the child in, I think it, and that's the person that the child is closest to, I think you need to work with the child to say, look, we need to tell mom. You can be in the room. You can tell her. I can tell her with you in the room, what would you feel most comfortable with? So you can offer some options. It's going to be anxiety provoking for the child when they realize their parent is going to have to know. But if you have a situation where you don't know who's hurt the child, for example, which does happen, more times when we're looking at physical injuries, then it's difficult because you don't know how much to tell the parent that's there. If there's any concern that that parent could be the one that's hurting the child, then you have to think about what your plan is. If you have an injury in a very young child, one thing to consider is transferring them to the hospital for further workup, and then they can be in that safe setting. And CPS would sometimes respond more quickly to that. So they would come to the hospital and begin to collect information then. So there's a lot of kind of case-by-case scenarios that can happen.
CPS can have this reputation of, and what we hear on the news, like kind of being overwhelmed, caseworkers can't really give the time that's needed, and then a child goes back to the family, and then that child is killed. You know, you see, hear stories like that, and what do you say to that? There's all these other things where they're helping the family. That's not what you see on TV news or reading the newspaper.
I know. And I admire people who go into child protection work.
I do too.
Because they deal with a lot more than we do as professionals, and they take a lot more flack from all ends, from not just parents. You have angry, screaming parents often. You have frustrations. You have doubt. Maybe things are not black and white. What do you do? I admire people that go into that, especially people that stay in the work, because expertise is so important in this field, and yet there's not much incentive to stay with. I would just say that professionals should be cooperative with child protection, and you can be, because if you suspect abuse and you report it, you are free to share that information without consent of the parent with anybody who's investigating the case. And so making sure that you explain your concern in clear terms that CPS can understand, being available for questions. You know, they struggle because they constantly are trying to get information from so many different professionals and so many different individuals and collaboratives. And it's a never-ending task, so it takes a long time to do that. But if you can make yourself available and be helpful to them, it makes their job so much easier.
And should you request that it be confidential if you're the pediatric practitioner making this call?
By law, if you're the reporter, it is confidential. And you can make that statement, but it is supposed to be confidential, yes.
And Dr. Kellogg, so you work at a place called the Center for Miracles, and you all are standing by. There's always someone on call. You're on call right now where a pediatrician, a pediatric practitioner, or someone on their team could call and talk to you.
We have an on-call number. And yes, we take calls from all different kinds of folks. We're also on call 24/7 for CPS. So they're workers that are in the field. What do you think of this? What do I do? Do I send this child to the hospital? We are trying to help them with those situations as well. Of course, we do an assessment. We still don't have all the information. CPS has a lot more information than we do. They know more about the circumstances in the home. They know more about the background. They know more about whether it's been previous referrals. They hold all of the information. So you're not the one making the determination. So the second thing to remember is that when you report, it doesn't always end up being validated, not a one-way street where the report happens, child taken out of the home, parents' custody is taken away. That's actually a very uncommon situation when you report suspected abuse. That doesn't happen very often. And most of the referrals that CPS gets are not validated for abuse and neglect. So to keep that in mind, but the other thing is to remember about CPS is they can provide the resources. They can make those other things happen if parents are having struggles. Perhaps they have a history. Perhaps they have an untreated disorder of some kind, whether it's a medical or mental disorder. CPS can be a resource to help those parents get healthier. We do know that children do well when they have healthy parents, when they have healthy caregivers. You know, what kids need is a safe, secure, nurturing relationship with another person. Well, that other person can't provide that if they are dealing with their own issues, you know, their own, you know, maybe they can't, they're worried about money or they're worried about food. You know, you talk about the social determinants of health, that plays into it too. So knowing that the caregiver, if they get help, they can care for their child better. CPS can play a role in making that happen as well. They are always looking at ways for that to happen, and they are very much aware of the resources that would be available to families for that. One thing to know is that child sexual abuse has been declining a little bit in numbers through the years, just kind of a slow decline. That's the good news.
Yes.
The bad news is that it's still a silent type of child abuse. It really depends on the child telling someone. That's how we learn about it. And many children still struggle with letting somebody know that they've been sexually abused. It's still very difficult for so many kids to tell. But yet that's the most common way that we diagnose is that child would tell someone that they've been sexually abused.
And on average, it's not until at least 2 years.
On average, what we found, we've done a couple of studies, and we did one many years ago, more than 20 years ago, and then one about 5 years ago. And in both of those studies, it was interesting to note that the average time was about 2 years, 2.3 years. Some children, of course, tell right away, and they may be seen in a hospital setting. But for many of those other children that are outside that acute window, they're waiting months to years to tell someone.
I know you have more than 135 publications, and you've been invited to present at numerous national and international conferences. What's the biggest question you get about sexual abuse?
Wow, about sexual abuse. Well, first they want to know why I'm still doing this.
Yep. But what do you say?
And what I say is that I really think it's a privilege and an honor to meet with these children. I'm kind of a glass half full kind of person.
I am too.
The fact that they told somebody and they're in my office and we're talking and we're making sure you're healthy and safe, those are all positive things. I worry about the children that haven't told, because if it's happening in their home, they're living with this adversity every day. And who are they turning to? Where are they going to find safety and peace? So I do think this is a privilege. I really do enjoy talking with the children that I meet. And part of that is because they teach me something new. Every time I talk with a child, I learn something new about how to do it better next time. You know, and I think a lot of this relates to what we call trauma-informed care. It's understanding, you know, how to have a conversation with someone who has experienced something that's changed their life. And that's a skill that has to be ever improving. Always find ways to do it better. So I've changed a lot. They taught me so much. They've given me so much. Children have an amazing capacity for forgiveness. And that always astounds me too. You know, you talk to a child and they're not interested in the other person going to jail. They don't have any anger. They just want their childhood back. They want a life where they're feeling safe and secure. And those are such basic things that we assume children have. And we have to remember there are some children who don't have that. And it's something they yearn for.
Wow. And sometimes I'm sure talking to kids, there's cases where they still, no matter what, will not say what's happened. And then that child may test positive for a sexually transmitted disease or something. And so, you know, they didn't tell. Or what do you do there? It's got to be so hard.
Those are difficult situations. And actually, it's an interesting question, because what we are finding is that the more severe the abuse is and the younger the child, for example, if children are subjects of pornography that involve other people, so actually filmed sexual acts, those children are the least likely to tell anybody. So that's an alarming thing to think about. So the more severe the sexual abuse, the less likely they are to actually tell someone what's happened, even though we know because we have video, or we know because we have an infection, or we know because we have an injury. So that means that the child is probably groomed to the point where they are not going to tell anybody.
That is so terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying to think of those children. That is a minority of the group, but it's still one that we worry about because those are the hardest to find sometimes.
And Nancy, is that because of the trauma, like a protective mechanism, or we just don't know?
It could be protective mechanisms. It could be, and some of the children we see have such trauma that they completely dissociate. Or it could just be what we call grooming. So they've been told that they should never, ever tell and that they are as much a part of the abuse. They're not, this isn't being done to them, it's being done with them. Mm. So they begin to change their mindset of how they view their own abuse. And so that's sometimes the reason why these kids won't tell.
Is there a misconception out there about abusers and people who are grooming kids that there are these mean people who are obviously bad guys, you know, or it's really, they're often seemingly very nice to the child?
Yeah. So you cannot recognize somebody who sexually abuses kids on the street. You cannot recognize children who have been sexually abused on the street. There's nothing about them that looks off. Most of the time, they just look like normal people. When people are sexually abusing children, they usually begin that process by being nice, by paying attention to the child at those talks, by basically violating their trust.
The child shouldn't be pressured to have to feel happy all the time. No one's happy all the time.
Tell me something about your day. Sometimes
feel funny or touching of adults,
and they look up to anything that bothers guidance. They think adults are the ones that are right. You know, we like,
and they're taught to better not, you know,
we like
talk back to the mom or dad or to the teacher, or
that's not everything.
Yeah, I think sometimes kids are brought up that way.
That whatever happened to you, if it's an adult, the things that
they know what they're doing, you just have to accept
it. So again, looking for those topics. I think it's less so now because I feel like parents.
And a lot of parents might be thinking like, oh, this,
I think
this wouldn't happen to my child.
That makes you feel uncomfortable. I want to know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what we
don't want it to ever.
I've always said that the best prevention for sexual abuse would be to have a bunch of little kids with a shirt that says, I think to know that. So when people perpetrate
everybody
abuse children, they are looking for a certain child. You know,
they're looking for a child who's
the whole spectrum.
It does happen.
Somebody
quiet,
someone who doesn't.
Especially sexual abuse.
Much to demographic or something that bothers.
That's the kind of child they want.
Yes, yeah, so
the denial can be difficult.
Counter that
to
a child
who,
you look at them, you say, you know, that's
very important to really
hear what the child says. I'm going to say don't
bite. In denial or you
It doesn't have to be something to happen to them. It can be something
being aware of
another child.
They're going
being
to speak
open
up.
To it.
That's not a good thing.
That's not a good
kid
to
me.
And so I think it's really more of that type of mentality. I hear,
you know, I would tell them, you know,
tell me, only told me a little bit.
And I think it's just the more open communication about those issues.
And
that can be the best for that
child know
on your turn,
your time,
when you say it's right, I'm ready to hear more if you want to share that.
I know it's a hot button topic, but do you have any advice for parents about
what
sleepovers,
do you recommend
summer camps say to families?
There's parents who won't
parents
ever let their kids
what should we
spend
be
the night
saying
at another child's house or go
regularly
to summer camp
to
and
kids.
Then there's the opposite and
somewhere
in between. I mean,
right.
And then how can you really know someone,
you know, we have
where they're going, you know,
and then we have
to spend the night?
Intervention after.
Yeah, I think that's a tricky topic.
Look at it
just to
add
guidance with parents.
You would investigate
daycare.
You might send your child
touch base with your child,
know something about,
find opportunity
to discuss how their day went.
But
just
also to pick
my
up on
some
I've
had some
very subtle situation.
Child
may
say,
I taught something today.
And maybe my kids were
busy
making dinner or something like that.
And
it's like, in context
I can't
pick up on that.
They're testing the waters.
So
they make a vague statement.
It might
like
be
that.
Happening.
Sometimes
I haven't
seen something.
Seen really needs to be discussed.
Is it usually?
You
haven't seen any of those. That's great to hear. And is it
Is it more typically someone who lives in the home, or is it cared
for the child to know? Even if I can't talk about it right now, I'm going to come back and talk abuse happening in the home and have the opportunity
about it.
Or have so pick up on some of those subtle cues, because kids will tug at the waters. It say something to so when
we do know that
to make them decide, I can say more.
And teenagers,
or as well,
no, it's better not.
People outside the home,
so they're making their own decisions.
They're more likely to tell that
and picking up on
consequences. Kid to say, and I think it's important.
Few, if you will.
Then it's not about breaking up a family. It's not about, you know, disrupting the family structure of any kind. It's not about.
I think it's
about.
Will
you can say you're not going to be in trouble. Some kids that's would one. Just hear be in trouble.
That's a good point.
You know, it's just a little bit like when we go into a physical exam, we say it's not going to hurt. All they hear is hurt.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you hurt the child? Don't
use that word.
Right. That's a good, really good point.
Yeah. So I think just touching base, talking to children.
So
if somebody is, if you pick up on something and you start to talk to the child and they seem hesitant,
for most children,
I think it's important to say,
you can say whatever you need to say,
it will be okay.
Is enough for that.
And not, they can tell.
Not get too much into the language. It may trigger a negative.
Let's look at a couple of cases.
That type of
thing. You had a patient. Brisa,
the pediatric practitioner,
am I pronouncing her name correctly?
As we all know, they have so much coming at them.
You've
right
never
now,
met her,
flu,
but
COVID,
only her parents
RSV,
through email.
So much.
Tell me about
stuff.
That. And it can be overwhelming so much to keep up with. But when it comes to child sexual abuse, it's that listening.
It's listening. They're very much learning something new every
what
day.
Children really need a safe, secure,
nurturing relationship in the context of when
and if they have that
and what that
they will understand how that happened,
how they're groomed,
and also if they have that, they can get through stressors.
And
so if it has something that bothers them,
but they have a caregiver,
I never met her parent.
That's safe,
but parents reached out to me because I had
published it soon.
And also they were just looking for
really
an approach.
They were from Bolivia.
Constantly building
a
relationship
with the child in Bolivia.
I think relationship, they have a very different view
can
of
really
sexual
affect violence.
The choices a child makes as they get older about whether to
not
to do something that might get them in
trouble.
Versus
happens,
not.
It's really
the
child is worried about what their parent
that
would
really
be
the child,
and the child shouldn't tell because
behavior.
They could.
So that's why
cause
that other person
to go to jail.
Cause
making
the
time
to
talk with the child alone.
And so
it's hard,
and it's
sometimes
family,
just not possible.
The first thing
with
it
the way
came out
lives
was
now.
The parents did not understand why she waited
now.
It's to and do it
so
on a frequent basis.
We discussed
do it so
to
child
through emails and faxes,
and it doesn't
that nature.
The child should be pressured to have to feel happy all the time. No one's happy
in this
all
case,
the time.
Tell me something about your day. It made you feel funny.
Her.
It made you feel hot.
Her,
but did
the
word
kind of thing
bothered you?
He knew her, so he knew what to say to make sure.
We like the good grades. We like the nice papers. We like
parents
will
be
faces.
Devastated by this if you tell them.
That's not
he
everything.
Was a family
a
member. Wasn't an immediate family
so
member.
They may struggle with other things, but not be used to talking about
remote family
things
members.
That don't feel so good.
I'll do this to your
so
sister.
So again, looking for those topics and those opportunities.
Okay, so this went on, and then
and a lot of parents might be thinking, like, oh, this
family,
this wouldn't happen to my child.
That he was an upstanding young man.
You don't want
they held him up
as
a role
child.
And so they just, so the two of them were
engaged
in
community projects
to kind of build
right.
and education.
I think to know that,
and they were doing this together,
it does have
lots of access.
Everybody.
And so I was just trying to help the parents,
you know.
She was also suicidal. She was the whole
spectrum.
Herself
happened
at that point.
At all levels.
She finally came out and talked
it's
about it.
It's actually sexual abuse.
The family was the one that
widespread.
Really just tried to give her
so
talk about
denial,
safe, secure, nurturing relationship
to get past.
Bruce's family, Bruce's parents, and
it's very important to really hear what the child said.
Sometimes you're not in denial or you're stressed.
Everything would get it
well.
They brought
so
it to
being
court,
aware of that.
The prosecutor,
and just being
the one
open
who's supposed
to
be on Bruce's
side,
sometimes
threatened her.
Parents
said, if you're saying one lie, I'm going
to
send you.
Well, she hasn't told me much about what happened.
They had a trial.
A little bit.
They
and
basically attacked
her.
They humiliated her.
She only told me a little bit.
Fun of her.
We have to keep our minds open.
There may be
her
more.
Family was physically threatened.
And all we can do is
let the child
try
to put the house on your terms, at your time.
Stoned at the house.
When you say it's right,
it was
I'm ready to hear more if you want.
3 years before they could even get a judge to agree to hear
it. I know it's kind of, it's so a hot it button topic, but do you have any advice for parents about sleepovers, summer camp? There's parents who won't ever let their kids spend the night at another child's house or go to summer camp. And then there's the opposite and somewhere in between. I mean, you think, and then how can you really know someone where they're going, you know, to spend the night?
And so I think a few years ago, I lost contact.
I think just as
going to trial,
who would investigate a daycare, you might think.
Did they find you somehow because they didn't have it in their own country?
To go. And they found me because I had been developing
to my experience.
I've had very few.
And they identified me from that.
I reached out to the people who put the educational material.
I've had.
They were looking for my contact, and they got in touch with that.
And in contact.
What had happened is Belisa,
an overnight camp.
Somehow, just so not only got through all this,
she thrived.
Seen many. She's a, what I call a thriver. She's amazing. But she came to the U.S. and she got legal education.
Well, the biggest threat
and
for
she,
a child,
basically, they had what they call a thematic hearing
in the home.
Inter-American Commission for Human Rights.
Will have
sued Bolivia in violation of human rights.
That's just the con.
And so there is this long hearing
so
when
court,
we do know
that
when
Bolivian
remedial action, they needed to establish
by
training, they needed to establish programs.
They're more likely
to help victims of that consequence. So in Bolivia,
sexual violence is more common.
Fewer than it is here.
It's like one in
about girls, one in five boys.
Breaking up
sexually assaulted.
It's not about,
you know, again, through Brisa, you know,
she has a nonprofit
family
structure
of any kind. It's not about that.
They
it's
have a huge success in
blaming,
trying
that's
cases.
One of the issues. But
there's
the
recognition
that
and they tend to
abuse
kids.
Usually don't have it
one.
When it's somebody
so
in
trying to use
a legal system,
trying to use education
and awareness
of what would happen,
consequence
to
hear these victims.
They're the ones that are holding.
And I don't like to call them victims because they're not.
So if you go to a sleepover, you go
anybody
to a camp,
you
leave
the camp.
You leave that house. You're safe.
That's a
great,
most children, a great point.
And safe and not.
So the family created a website.
And
in the title of the website, it's Breeze of Hope.
Abreezeofhope.org. Yeah.
Who we are.
Let's
look at a couple of cases in the podcast text as well. So you had a patient, Brisa.
And
they want people to know.
You've
never met her, hoping to
prevent
her parents through email.
More abuse.
Tell me about that.
And they're really so.
They're going where the need is the most.
I did some of those.
While she is
here,
families
in Bolivia.
Why kids tell?
And
don't,
you know, they have.
They did get Bolivia.
They're very much learning something new
day
every day
about
the day
of disclosure
of sexual abuse,
violence,
especially
sexual
in the context.
That's great.
They had a march. And what that dynamic,
I remember
that happened, she indicated she was expecting, the first time they had it was a few years ago,
and
Brisa was 15 at the time, and I never met her, I never met her parents.
They can see the things
they're
doing. But
her parents reached out to me
because
I had published this paper.
Because
the
government
is not
any information.
Yeah, they were from Bolivia.
For the remedial.
They are in Bolivia. It's held in Bolivia.
And
they just persist.
They have a very different view
and
of
I think
sexual
it's because
violence.
They've been able to help so many people.
They,
it's not that
they
to them.
They've helped
them happen.
They believe
if it happens, it's really the child's fault.
They've helped them with all those things.
Mm.
So
it's
really
the child.
That's
a
little
child
miracle going on.
Maybe a big miracle going on.
Cause that other person to go to jail.
Cause the family to be shamed.
And so she sounds like she's doing amazingly well.
Brisa. Family.
Is that often a side effect though, before a child tells
the suicidal
tendencies? And
so
as we know, there's an epidemic
in
this country now with mental health
would not
problems in kids and depression.
In this case, he threatened
it's very common in adolescent
life. He threatened her with the worst kind of thing.
Sometimes
he knew her,
so he knew what
related to
make sure she didn't experience.
But
your parents would be devastated
not a
by
the school
tell
us.
So
he was
a
family
man.
It wasn't an immediate family member.
I would say it's probably higher in the adolescents
that I've seen compared
I'll do this to your sister.
Not
don't let me do it
to
you.
Okay, yes. So this went on, and then in the background of it, that's her family.
From when I began,
that he was an upstanding young man, and that they held him up as a role model. When families come to the bank, we were engaged in a community project and trying to build into me education for the need in Bolivia.
Food, they
went together,
so they had lots of access to her.
But the number one
and
most
so I was just trying to help the parents, family.
She was also about is, I just want my child to get therapy. I wanted that to point
for him to get.
She finally came out and talked about
that's
it.
That's encouraging,
and
but
family was the one really tried to give her.
Never had a drug.
Talk about safe, secure, nurturing relationship. Reese's family, Reese's parents, and her siblings had
never
judged them.
They never got
because everything was against them.
It's a very comprehensive.
They brought it to court.
Situation.
The prosecutor, the one
and in this country, the statistics that I've read
is
for girls, every one in four
they had a trial
will be abused in their lifetime, sexually abused.
They humiliated her, her that threatened her
prediction for boys.
Family
left
physically.
So one in five. But one in five.
They had
some
five.
Is it? But it does happen to boys.
It was.
So I think that.
3 years.
Might be a misconception that's out there that it can't happen to boys.
So
I think that is a misconception.
Horrendous. And we talk about you have the sexual abuse trauma,
and
then you have this whole other horrific trauma where you stop.
Victim is
the
one on trial.
She was the one that had to defend herself.
They're also more.
And what's amazing in all of this is they believed it happened, but it was her fault.
You know, we have a questionnaire. We, of course,
so
ask kids about
a few years ago, I lost contact with them.
About
I knew
the
they
matter,
were
with
going
at
that time.
Are they having trouble in school?
Did they find you somehow because they didn't have it in their own country?
And I worry about that.
I had been developing some educational material.
At some point,
and they identified
they
me from that.
What happened to them?
To so the people who put the education on the
hill in the future. I worry about
looking
it
for my
out.
Contact, and they got in touch with me.
And tell kids
what had happened.
It
really
helps.
Somehow,
not just to get
just what happened to you out, but to get
not only
got through all this,
out,
you
thrive.
It's like a splinter.
She's what I call it.
You have a splinter in your
fiber.
And it hurts a whole lot.
But she came to the U.S.
that she got legal education.
Hurt anymore.
And so I think that when
they had a,
what they call it,
a dramatic hearing.
The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
Yeah, you know, it does happen
Bolivia
for violation
and,
of human rights.
Just being aware,
so there is this long hearing, and
the court ruled that Bolivia had to take
sometimes
remedial action. They needed to establish training. They needed to establish programs.
If it's something
to
I don't like,
victims
I'm
of
a
sex
boy,
violence.
I'm so in Bolivia,
sexual violence is more common
than
it's younger. It's like one in three girls, one in five boys.
So it's something that they, I think, struggle with sometimes.
You know, again, so Brisa, she has a nonprofit now. They've helped.
When I was a news reporter at one of the stations I worked at, and KSAT here in San Antonio, but all news stations, you hear the police and fire scanner all day, and the assignment editor is listening, you know, for that. It's called Spot News that's happening, and most of it ends up being family violence and abuse that's happening. And that was, I mean, as that's
about,
and most of it doesn't make the news, but you hear it all day as a reporter.
Point.
It's just horrible.
So
the family created
a
website.
So it's
more common than I think most people
realize.
The title
realize.
Of the website is Breeze of Hope, breezeofhope.org, who we are. And we'll put that in the podcast text as well.
So the stories, we ask them separately because
they want people to know.
It's so brave to share. I don't know how this is going.
And in sharing, they're hoping to prevent
and they have no
more abuse.
And they're really
no more than
they're going where the need is the most.
And
while she
very
is
much aware.
Here, families in Bolivia,
the booze is.
And you know they have. They
the
did get
day,
and they can put a day
together,
in August
and
a day for
not.
Sexual.
You know,
we have to remember that violence.
That's great.
They had March
advert.
I remember
talking about
the journal.
They indicated she was
infected.
The first time they had it was a few
years ago,
and
it
was
affecting
violence.
They
have
a caregiver.
They
had
challenges
with
mental health.
They can see the things they're doing.
All of those things.
It's so slow
because
the government is not
stepping up yet.
There are times when
for the remedial
children
actions,
would say, yeah, that's going on in my home.
But they just put
you know, I've heard this person and because they've been able to help so many.
And the caregivers saying,
never.
They've reached out to them.
So again, we don't cut any kids.
They're very attentive. They've helped them with all those things going on in their home.
And
that's a little miracle going on. Maybe a big miracle going on
in Bolivia that's very heartening.
Nancy, can you, for the pediatric practitioner, can you explain the process of how does the family get
is
to
that
you,
often a side you, effect though before a child pediatrician tells calls the
child protective the services
suicidal tendencies
and what happens?
As we know, there's
so we have
an epidemic in this country now with mental health problems in kids and depression,
sexual abuse.
It's very common in adolescents.
That I research here, we're talking about like within 90. Sometimes it is.
It's eventually related to within 96 hours.
Well, you know what happened within
but there's also just a lot of trauma.
Or that child has some pain or bleeding.
A lot of bullying.
We want them to go to the hospital.
And right now,
I would say
probably higher pediatric program at the children's
that I see compared to those that do not experience
the Christus children's rather.
And then we have,
again, it's so sometimes not that it's
definitely older adolescents.
From when I
mostly
began
it'll before. Be quick
many years ago.
Much more increased.
If it is beyond that period of time and something that's
when
happened.
Families come to our clinic, we are very
then the report is
trying to meet their needs.
So
their
needs
what will happen next
is initially that child
sheltered,
will get a
forensic interview at child.
But the number one most common
child savings
and
the
family
tell us about
is
I just want my child to get
therapy.
I want my child healthy, him to get help.
And do most cities,
often,
states, they have a child protective services? It's called that? Or is it called? It depends. The number to call when you suspect abuse, is it called
different?
Statewide number.
Sometimes families will call law enforcement for a situation.
So law enforcement is also...
And in this country, the statistics that I've read is it for girls, every one in four will be abused in their lifetime, sexually abused?
That's like one in five
reported to the law enforcement who lost
the coordination. For boys, it's less common.
So one in
like
five.
One in 20, yeah.
But one in five. Nancy, another child that stands out, is it, but it does happen, 11-year-old Rachel, because I think
so she had experienced numerous
might be a misconception
traumas.
That's
tell
out there
me
that
about
can't happen
her case.
To boys.
So I think that is a misconception.
Rachel taught me a lot.
I really had to respect a little bit different focus. She was very upfront about what she was going to allow and what she was
home that I think.
And as I met her,
but
one thing I did realize with her before I share her story,
close
every child, every child
that we see,
you know, we have questionnaires,
of course,
unspoken
about
self
injury, unspoken questions when they come
to us about what they're mad at, what they're afraid of. Are they having trouble?
They're not sure whether to share those or not.
And for boys,
it's
really
likely
to be John
to try to not
own.
And
I worry about that because
at
some point,
them to be able to share.
I think they have to work on what happened
to
them. So
Rachel came in and she had a lot of history. I worry about making out
several different placements,
several different.
It really helped.
She was there for
not just to get what happened to you out, but to get.
The feeling
came in
and out.
She did not want
splinter.
So I have to
tell
you about that.
Well,
I
heard
four of them.
And it hurts a whole lot when you take it out, but then it's telling me what they are.
And then she said, you know,
so I use
don't
that
lie to
me.
Younger kids sometimes. So
don't give me
shots. Important.
Don't talk about my mother.
You know,
it
don't
does
tell
me
to
do something.
Media,
I will be aware
of that because I
think.
And so I think.
Yeah,
and
sometimes people come in and
they
have these
more
burdens
guilt.
And they have these demands and they have this anger.
And they're expecting us to say
something I don't like.
You know,
you can go away and come back another day.
I think they
expect to push
I'm
back.
Strong
and I said, okay,
and
let's talk about
each of those.
Okay, I promise not
to. So it's that they have been struggling.
I promise no shot. You can look
that
at my arm.
Go along with half a shot.
I will
when I was a news reporter and just at one of the stations I worked at, KSAT here in San Antonio, but all news stations, you hear the police and fire scanner all day, and the assignment editor is listening, you know, for that. It's called spot news that's happening, and most of it ends up being family violence and abuse that's happening, and that was
I mean, as
so what's that's, funny about that?
And most of it doesn't make the news, but yeah. you hear it all day as a reporter. It was just horrible to hear. And
she
it's,
talked about
so it's more common than I think most people realize.
She talked
realize.
About everything that she said. Yeah. So family violence is. It's domestic violence. We always
and she
ask
went
about
to the
that.
Exam.
We had no issue. Kit, and we also asked her. But caregivers, I just, we ask them separately.
There's always something
sometimes caregivers think, okay.
I was just thankful that
she,
this is going
she knew
on
what she had to tell me about
room,
what the rules were.
And they have no awareness.
You know, the rules are often
children know more than and the caregivers think.
Recognize
and they are often
and
very
trying
much
to
aware.
Build that
and
they
see
to sometimes. Someone.
Boost.
To me, it's always been a gratitude.
On their caregivers
the next day, and they can put it together.
I understand
someone.
What's going on.
Can I build the bridge?
We have to remember that.
Violence
to the point
that it's an adverse childhood event.
Enough,
we talk about the
to share
kids survey.
A lot of kids won't tell you that up front. What this is what
the violence,
I'll talk to you if this, this, and this. I'll tell you the truth.
They don't tell you
up front.
It's up to you to try to figure it out as you go into the conversation.
I try to understand
there are
what
times when
about.
What their fear.
Children were saying.
And
yes.
so, and Rachel was protective of her mother.
Seen or heard, this person
did not like a mother.
She blamed
the caregiver
for all the different placements.
So again, we don't credit kids.
So
it sounds like, I mean, her mother had a lot of her own
issues,
and they were not getting out of their home
appropriately
or completely addressed.
It's enough for her to be
as
safe to
them.
It has an effect on them.
And you know, that
Nancy, can you, for the pediatric practitioner, can you explain the process of how does the family get to you or the child get to you? If the pediatrician calls Child Protective Services,
and that's hard, Brandon.
Then
that
is.
We want every child.
So we have a pretty good
person.
Protocol
that can be
their
person.
They're
a safe
so
person.
When
it's just not something we can take abuse
and it
and she knew that because she was in those situations
we're
that
about, like,
is what put her at risk.
Hours. Yeah, I mean, she blamed
happened with
she blamed her mother for all her different.
You know,
I don't know exactly, and I didn't want to push her to do it because
you know bleeding.
Again, their background, they can share
as
much about it as they
right
wish.
Now, here in San Antonio,
for me, it was more about
whatever was going to work for her, whatever was going to make her feel better,
children,
I wanted her
to
share.
And
but as a medical provider,
I didn't
so
have
sometimes
to know that.
I try to stay very focused on what
habits,
I actually
but
need
mostly
to know.
It'll be quick to children.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to
be, it's beyond that period
delve
of time
into
something
detail.
Has happened, at least
I don't have to have
if they want to share it and that helps
then
them,
the report
great.
Is the first step but I am not going to try to
what will happen next is it usually that
any other take home messages about Rachel that you would want the pediatric practitioner to know about in
Center for Miracles,
learning
and
moments
we schedule the child to be seen there.
None that I can think of. I just think it you know being transparent and honest with kid. I think a lot of times when we're in a pediatric office, we have the caregiver there, we have the child there. We're not talking with the child alone. And so many times, I think we preferentially always talk to the parent, but talking to the child first and say, you know, how are you doing today? Not how are we today or what's going on today to the parent, but addressing the child directly. I don't know if children are as used to that. And to let them know they have a voice in this checkup.
That's a great point. And to say the child's name.
Right. Right.
Nancy,
and,
another
know,
child that stands
so
out is 11-year-old Rachel. So
and
she had experienced
today.
Numerous
so this
traumas.
This is what we're
going
to do.
Tell
we
me about
make sure
her case.
It. We're going to check your body from head to toe.
Rachel taught me a lot.
I really had to respect her. Yeah.
But she was very
upfront
about
they
what she was
should
going
have
to allow.
This is about their body, their health.
And I met her.
So understand
one thing
that
I did realize
deserves
some respect
is that every
with
child
role
every
and what
that
parent
that we see
about has a set.
That's really wonderful. Is there anything else you want to say about sexual abuse to the practitioner?
And they're not sure what
Well, I mean, I think it's
so
really
it's really
three basic ways that I've learned that
children can present to
can't expect
a pediatrician
to
try to
own
it. Concern to sexual
and to try to encourage them to
first
be able
is
to
that
their questions
they told somebody.
Well,
and as Rachel came in,
before,
she had a lot of
ways
that we find out.
She had been in several different
I think when a practitioner gets a call from a caregiver, my child just told me this, this, and this, and the child
said it very clearly.
Came in.
And
they're of an age,
she did not want the exam.
Five and
I
older.
Said, well, tell me about it.
Said, I have
14 a legitimate statement.
Okay. that is something that
should
be referred to either the hospital or to
pediatrics. Don't lie to me.
I don't think the pediatrician needs
don't give me
that child unless the parent
don't
talk about my mother specific reason why they
don't tell me to do something immediate
so they can be referred. I think where the trick is when the child tells someone.
So I think
have a very young child.
Sometimes people come in
and they have these demands and they have the anger.
And so no, it's not always clear that sexual abuse is a concern.
You can go away and come back another day.
I think they expect the pushback. So those
and I said, okay, let's talk about it.
Okay, I promise not to lie.
A lot of these kids are coming to
me. I promise
no shots. You can look at my office. I have no shots about their sexual behaviors.
I will not talk about you.
And we've learned a lot about sexual behaviors in children.
We know that it's very frequent. There's a wide variety of sexual behaviors
after
they're young children.
What I think we need to do for your health and safety.
So
and we can make
be knowledgeable about
what's
normal.
So
and what's
again, medicine
is a cooperative venture.
Can go a long way because
always trying to get
caregivers get their answers when they see their children.
And so what's funny about that is that she's
touching themselves too
totally
much,
everything.
Touching themselves
when
public,
I agree to who or
not knowing what to do with it,
getting angry with
she talked about her mother.
So
the perception
she
of caregiving
sometimes
she wouldn't
affects
do.
The frequency of the behavior.
And she went through the exam.
And
fine.
I think the pediatrician
no
can have a really important role in trying
but
to clarify what's
I just,
normal.
There's always something
clarifying the appropriate responses to those.
I was just thankful that she knew what
the third thing about what the rules
and
were.
And is there anything you want to mention specifically for the pediatric listener to,
that's
to say?
So sexual behaviors in children is a whole other topic.
We could do another podcast on that.
But I will say in general, as a
part of my job,
if children don't understand the social taboos yet, like they don't know you're supposed to
get to the point where
the
person
probably won't know you're not supposed to put your hand on your private to share with her. So it's not necessarily
a lot of kids won't tell you that up front.
It's
what,
not
this
even
is
sexual.
What, I'll talk to you if this, this, and this. I'll tell you the truth.
They don't tell you.
It's up to you
to try to figure it out.
So it's not always a sexual gratification to try to understand behind each other
what their curiosity is.
And so, and Rachel was protective of her mother?
Sometimes it's up to them.
She
did not like her mother.
She blamed her mother
for
all the appointments that she had to go to.
As they get older,
it sounds like her mother had a lot of
her own but they're more
we're not getting
COVID.
We don't appropriately addressed enough for her to be a safe, secure
person. But they're still very interested in sexual talk.
And, you know, that's
something
you know,
that kids sometimes talk
if
about.
We have a child
in the parent
who is engaged in sexual behavior
they
with
didn't
another child
needed
and one or both.
And that's how children are very distraught.
That is,
I want every child,
one child
to be able to have a person.
That's a situation you have to
that can be their person.
And you have
their
to find
person.
Out more about that.
And that's just not something we can take
for
granted.
And she
not
knew
all
that
of those kids
because she was in those situations that is what
things,
put her at risk.
Like the age.
Yeah. I mean, she blamed
types.
She blamed her mother for all her
appointments.
I don't know exactly. And I didn't want to push her to do it because, again, their background, they can share as much of that as they wish to. For me, it was more of a whatever was going to work for her, whatever was going to make her feel better, I wanted her to share. But as a medical provider, I didn't have to know that. I try to stay very focused on what I actually need to know. You know, I'm not going to delve into details that I don't have to have. If they want to share it and that helps them, that's great. But I am not going to try to pull things out.
Any other take-home messages about Rachel that you would want the pediatric practitioner to know about? Any learning moments?
None that I can think of. I just think it, you know, being transparent and honest with kids. I think a lot of times when we're in a pediatric office, we have the caregiver there, we have the child there. We're not talking with the child alone. And so many times, I think we preferentially always talk to the parent, but talking to the child first to say, you know, how are you doing today? Not how are we today or what's going on today to the parent, but addressing the child directly. I don't know if children are as used to that. And to let them know they have a voice in the checkup.
That's a great point. And to say the child's name.
Right, right. And, you know, explain to say, so you're here for your 5-year checkup today. So this is what we're going to do because we have to make sure you're healthy. We're going to check your body from head to toe, you know, and then we're going to do some tests. Yeah. But just respecting that they should have this information. This is about their body, their health. So understanding even a 5-year-old deserves some respect for their role and what that pediatric visit is about.
That's really wonderful. Is there anything else you want to say about sexual abuse to the practitioner?
I think it's really 3 basic ways that I've learned that children can present to a pediatrician's office with concerns for sexual abuse. So first is that they told somebody. And as we said before, this is the most common way that we find out about sexual abuse. I think when a practitioner gets a call from a caregiver, my child just told me this, this, and this, and the child has said it very clearly, and they're of an age, you know, 5 and older, where it seems like a legitimate statement, that is something that, you know, should be referred to either the hospital or to CPS immediately. I don't think the pediatrician needs to see that child unless the parent has some specific reason why they want to bring them in. So they can be referred. I think where the trick is when the child tells someone is that when you have a very young child, let's say a 3 or 4-year-old, sometimes they'll make a statement that's difficult to interpret. And so it's not always clear that sexual abuse is a concern here. And it may require some further clarification. So those are, you know, that's the most common way, sexual abuse. But a lot of these kids are coming to pediatricians because parents are concerned, caregivers are concerned about their sexual behaviors. And we've learned a lot about sexual behaviors in children. We know that it's very frequent. There's a wide variety of sexual behaviors that very young children, preschool children, can have. So being knowledgeable about what's normal and what's not normal in terms of sexual behaviors can go a long way because sometimes caregivers get very anxious when they see their children sexually touching themselves too much or touching themselves in public, not knowing what to do with it, getting angry with the child. So the perception of the caregiver sometimes affects the frequency of the behavior. And I think a pediatrician can have a really important role in trying to clarify what's normal and clarifying the appropriate responses to those kinds of behaviors. So the third thing that can happen.
And is there anything you want to mention specifically for the pediatric listener to, say?
So sexual behaviors in children is a whole nother topic.
We could do another podcast on that.
But I will say in general, as a rule of thumb, if children don't understand the social taboos yet, like they don't know you're not supposed to pick your nose in public, they probably won't know you're not supposed to put your hand on your privates in public. So it's not necessarily a deliberate action. It's not even sexual for some children. Maybe they have an itch or they're curious or they simply want to do something that would draw the caregiver's attention. So it's not always a sexual gratification motive behind these behaviors. It's curiosity. It's a lot of different things. It's soothing. Sometimes it's self-soothing to children, and that's not bad, but sometimes it has to be redirected. It may not be appropriate. As they get older, these behaviors are still there, but they're more covert. We don't see them. We don't see kids doing this in public anymore, but they're still very interested in sexual topics. So you know, obviously, if we have a child who is engaged in sexual behavior with another child and one or both children are very distraught by it, they're agitated, or one child is being really forceful, that's a situation you have to intervene with and have to find out more about that behavior to see what the best management is. Not all of those kids have to be reported to CPS. There's a lot of things to think about, like the ages of the children, the type of sexual behavior it is. Is it persistent? All of those things have to be considered. So it gets complicated when we get to that. So, you know, there's clinical report and AAP on sexual behaviors of children. We're getting ready to redo that. Sexual behaviors is really on a spectrum. So there's some things are completely normal and then other things are gray zone. And then there's some that are clearly not normal, require intervention, treatment, and sometimes reporting. So being kind of aware of those types of behaviors and being able to guide the caregiver.
many of the ones we get are in the normal range, but the caregiver doesn't like it, and they're worried that something's happened to the child. And many times that's just not something that we find, or we're not able to determine if that happened. So sexual behavior is a big topic, but it's one that, you know, it's probably presents to pediatricians' offices not infrequently.
And we could put the AEP link about sexual behaviors
you,
in there?
You can.
But and you're working on that?
Well, it's not going to be for a while before it comes out. I'm working on it with Dr. Kassoon, actually. And so the iteration of the original one, which I did when I was on the AEP committee, that'll be coming sometime, in a couple of years probably, the way the process is.
And that's Dr. Natalie Kassoon, who's part of the child abuse pediatric team, a doctor right. on the team
yeah.
here at the University of Texas Health Science Center.
Yeah. So that's important. There's just so many things to think about with sexual behavior, and cultural factors are also very big because different cultures and ethnicities view these behaviors differently too. So the perspective, again, of the caregiver, their culture, their background, their own experiences can play into the interpretation of these behaviors. So just keeping that in mind. And the third way that these children can present to a pediatric office is with some type of genital complaint. So maybe there's redness there, there's irritation, there's a discharge, there's maybe even some blood. And the caregiver is concerned that this is trauma, that this could be sexual abuse. And so those children would obviously need to be examined. But I will say that in the absence of a history or anything else, most of the time those kids with genital complaints are going to have something else. It's not going to be trauma. It's going to be something else that mimics trauma, or it can be trauma that's not due to sexual abuse. So, for example, children can get small anal fissures that cause spots of blood in the underwear or the diaper, and that is a common cause of seeing blood in the diaper or the underwear.
That has nothing to do with sexual abuse.
Right, right. So those are the three basic ways.
Okay. Anything else you want to, this has been so enlightening. Anything else you?
It's important, just as Child Protective Services does not always find abuse, neither do we at Center for Miracles. And so the way that we like the system to be is to have a low threshold for reporting at the front line. So those are the pediatricians, the hospital folks, the emergency department folks. We want low threshold. And then if we look at the injury, usually what happens is we identify additional information we need to have. It might be scene information. It might be more details from the parent. It might be details from the child. So we, through Child Protective Services, get this additional information, and very often it goes from a suspicion to either nonspecific or no concerns. And that's okay, because we're watching out for kids. That's the whole goal here. So it's been a nice system for working that way, because then we less likely to miss children that really do need help, really do need those assessments.
So if you suspect something, call Child Protective Services, just as that, just the suspicion.
Suspicion is all the law requires for your report. And again, you're not making a decision. You're not making a determination. You're saying, I'm suspicious, more is needed to look into this. That's what you're saying. You know, you're not going to do everything. You're not going to do the investigation. So I think and sometimes if pediatricians get frustrated, oh, nothing happened. Know that there's a lot that happened in between, but they may not be aware of the additional information that was collected.
I know you've made such a difference, and you continue to do that, but you consider your family your greatest contribution. And here on Pediatrics Now, we like to promote having a life outside of medicine with all of the high stress of this career and high burnout. You enjoy hiking and camping with your family?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, I never take it for granted that I was blessed enough to be able to give a safe, secure, nurturing relationship to my children. So many families I meet, by no fault of their own, they just have too many challenges.
are not able to do that for their children. So for me, being able to provide that, it's just, that's why it's my greatest accomplishment. I was able to do that for them. And my work has made me understand how important a gift that is, you know. So, but getting away from it all and really having a whole different perspective of there's a whole other world out there and just becoming immersed in looking around you beyond your only, the very small universe, look at the big universe and just understand that you're one piece in the big picture. It's always helped me with perspective and being able to come back and get back to work. It's just, we did camping with my kids all through their childhood years. And I hope they had good memories with that. I think they did. But it was just a wonderful time. And again, you didn't have cell service when we went.
It's so nice.
Phones were off, or even if they were on, they weren't working. And it was just wonderful to be able to devote that time to each other and just talking and just reconnecting. You know, my kids would connect with each other. It was just a great time that we all look forward to. And so we just try to keep that tradition through all the way up until about high school.
That's really beautiful. And I'm going to edit this part back in. But one question I forgot is, do you want to say anything about social media and sexual abuse there, or a whole other?
Right. It's our concept of sexual abuse has expanded greatly, and not in a good way. And so we have trafficking now. We have a lot of children involved in pornography. We have, unfortunately, a lot of adolescents involved, a lot of them not by choice, with sexting. So they will receive nude pictures from random strangers. For some, it's distressing. For others, they think it's funny. I worry a little bit about that being a new norm for kids, because they kind of giggle about it when they tell me. And I'm just concerned, because I have seen situations where these sects that have been used for blackmail, used to humiliate kids, they've been used as a form of bullying. And so they can be, it's a huge leverage for someone to have over an adolescent. So I think, again, a lot of the adolescents I see, they're meeting somebody online and they're meeting up with them and then not expecting and not prepared to protect themselves. And then they're being sexually assaulted. So they're very open with their trust. And I worried about what I call the self-protective skills. And, you know, when I work with them and work with families, I tell them, you know, what I really hope from all this is that they learn to protect themselves. They begin to recognize and anticipate the dangers, because the choices they're making are sometimes devastating choices in terms of lifelong adversities that they face.
Is the sexual abuse online, is that that's happening with photos, words, videos? And then sometimes someone in person trying to connect with them.
Yeah. So it's all different types now. It's not just about touching anymore. It's verbal. It's harassment. Again, there's a spectrum of behaviors that are highly concerning. Exploiting people. That's very worrisome to me. And it just seems that so many kids are at risk for it.
And anything you want to mention quickly just about how do we protect our children from that? Is it know what they're looking at online? I know. How do we do that? It's like, and there's all these new website, new social media stuff. It's how do you access that? And
I don't know. I'm not on social media at all.
I'm not either anymore.
I've long given that up. I ask them, what do they do when they get these images from people they don't know or they do know? And many of them just say, I just block them. And I said, well, why don't you have a conversation with your parent about it too? So again, harkening back to the importance of a parent-child connection, I'm not sure parents can completely protect their kids from this, which is worrisome. But they can be there for them to help them make the healthy choices when they get to that point. Remember, so if the adolescent is trying to decide, do I send a nude picture of myself or not? And the next thought is, what would my parents say? That's going to be a modifier. So again, building those very strong, healthy, close relationships can be a preventative measure for things like that when they get into trouble with social media.
That's great advice. Dr. Nancy Kellogg, Division Chief for Child Abuse, thank you so much for being here today on Pediatrics Now.
Children from that.
And Dr. Nancy Kellogg with the University of Texas Health Science Center, University Hospital, and the Center for Miracles, thank you for being here. Thank you so much for listening to Pediatrics Now. Don't forget to click on the link in this podcast for free credit that may include CME, MOC, or ethics credit, depending on the topic or podcast. For episode ideas, you can email me. Go to our website, pediatricsnowpodcast.com. You'll find my email address on there. I'd love to hear feedback and let me know what you think. If you know anyone who may be interested in Pediatrics Now, please share. I'm Holly Waymont. Thank you so much for listening and for making a difference. One pediatrician said to me the other day, it's really hard to be a pediatrician these days. We hope by listening to the podcast, we can help make it easier. We can give you the updates that you need and topics that you want to know more about.